Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp. In studio with me is Ben Golliver, and on the other line, we have Rob Mahoney. What's up, Rob?
Hey, guys. We made it through the week. We're alive. We still have our jobs. That's a success.
Yeah, no kidding. I'm really impressed that both of you are currently able to form sentences. The top 100 is out. It is done. Ben, how are you feeling right now?
Not too much, Andrew. You kind of screwed the intro up, if you don't remember. But I'm feeling great. I'm feeling celebratory. I'd also say we call the top 100 not only because there's 100 players on it, but because we have achieved basically at this point 100% approval rating from across the board. It doesn't matter if it's league executives, players, fans, anonymous internet commentators. I mean, basically everyone agrees with our list, Andrew. It's a phenomenal feeling when you have this kind of validation in the world. And, you know, I'm just kind of sitting back enjoying it. I spent the morning at a drone museum. We can probably get into that later.
We're not going to lead off with drones right now. I'm not letting you do that. Okay. I know you're riding high.
Fair enough. I'm just saying this podcast is all part of sort of my, kind of championship parade, if you
yeah,
will.
Yeah, you're taking a victory lap. I'm here to bring you guys back down to earth because there are some real suspect calls on the top 100 that I've been waiting to address. Ben, so Rob, I don't know if you know this. I thought we were going to do the top 100 pod on Tuesday, and Ben wouldn't let us do it because he was afraid of revealing the top 20 too early. So now we can finally talk through this, which will be nice. Off the top, Rob, I want to congratulate both of you guys on some big wins this year. Number one, you did not have Paul Millsap as a top 15 NBA player, which is fantastic. You did not have Derek Favors. Last year, basically, overall, this year's list makes a lot more sense than last year. So I was genuinely horrified by Parsons at 50 last year. Derek Favors was the 28th best player, according to you guys.
You're fixating on past history.
No.
Stick to the list. You've learned a lot about basketball over the last 12 months. That's why this list makes a lot more sense. Rob and I have been rubbing off on you.
What I'm saying,
stick to the script.
You did a great job this year. It's not as repulsive to me reading the top 100. And we should read the top 15 here at the start. Because I think you guys nailed the top 15. Rudy Gobert, 15. Karl Anthony Towns, 14. John Wall, 13. Paul George, 12. 11, Jimmy Butler. 10, Draymond Green. 9, Giannis. 8, Anthony Davis. 7, Chris Paul. 6, Russell Westbrook. 5, James Harden. 4, Kawhi Leonard. 3, Steph. 2, KD. 1, LeBron. So in that top 15, was there any particular debate that you found hardest?
I mean, I think the one that really that we really got stuck on a lot was Steph versus Kawhi. And it's a matter of splitting hairs on a superstar level, which is always fraught with problems, just because you're lucky to have either of those guys. You're lucky to deal with any of their limitations and to ride any of their strengths. And, you know, Curry is a guy who I think, you know, we're not going to make the argument that he's as balanced a player as Kawhi, because that would be crazy. But when you look at what Kawhi has done to kind of elevate his game as a scorer, he's just now getting up to kind of what Steph's down year performance as a scorer looks like. And I think what gives Curry, or what ultimately gave Curry the edge for us, is just that he has this universal impact on an offense that isn't really matched anywhere. I mean, he basically has rendered entire swaths of the league completely obsolete. Like, if you're a certain type of center, you just can't play against the Warriors anymore. If you're a wing player who kind of falls asleep at the wheel when you're off ball, the Warriors are just going to run your guy through off ball screens all day, and you're going to have to guard Steph. And so he really demands a certain kind of personnel be on the floor, and in doing so, makes it that much harder to play even your good players if you're playing against his team. And like, that kind of constant impact, the fact that he's really the ultimate make guys better superstar, combined with maybe the most accommodating superstar in the league, given that he just gave up so much just so Kevin Durant could be his teammate, that's a really hard thing to top. And it really kind of gave him a unique case, I think, for our list.
Yeah, let's be honest. I was the one pushing pretty hard for Kawhi, and you talked me out of it.
See, wait, you were trying to knock Steph down?
I was.
Because Rob's preaching to the choir right here. I would have Steph number two.
Well, we've determined that you're the Steph Curry fanboy recently. I mean, you have really been waving his flag pretty hard. But here's my initial instinct was, well, Kawhi's offense is better than Steph's defense. Therefore, this whole best two-way player idea kind of comes in, and maybe he's a better all-around guy. I think one thing that Rob mentioned is like the vacuum test. If you throw both these guys on a random team with a random assortment of teammates, the odds that Steph's going to take you to an elite offense are better than Kawhi's going to take you to an elite defense, because he's not a center. He's not a backline guy. Yeah. And I think having the ball in his hands and having this insane shooting ability where there's always going to be two or three guys going towards him virtually guarantees Steph and four dudes are going to be able to be a juggernaut offensively. And that's a good place to start. And I think that was ultimately we decided that Steph's offense, his total package, his total impact was the best in the league. And that was sort of the tiebreaker in terms of impact between him and Kawhi.
Yeah, we had an emailer last year compare his effect on NBA defenses to Randy Moss's effect on NFL defenses. And that still, to me, is like the best way to explain it. So, yes, good job on the top 15. I feel like you nailed pretty much everything. The only other debate that I think is pretty close would be Giannis versus Anthony Davis. But I think you came out on the right side there as well. Now let's go to the bottom of the list, because really like 100 through 30 is where there's some of the best debates. Look at some of the guys you left off here. Dion Waiters.
Missed half the season.
Joe Ingles. Or Joe Ingles, whatever. Andre Roberson, Malcolm Brogdon, Jabari Parker. And look at some of the people you have in the bottom 20 that I'm not sure why they're on the list. Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, why did he make it?
He's one where I think we're a little more perspective on him, just because of his age and his situation and the fact that it clearly hasn't clicked for him yet. You know, if you want him to be a 3-and-D guy, the 3-point percentage clearly isn't there yet. The defense, I think, has been up and down depending on his health and his circumstances. But what we've seen in terms of the highs, like, he could be one of the most important, like, type of on-ball defenders in the league, a guy who can take away these kind of Steph Curry, Damian Lillard, Kyrie Irving-like pull-up jump shooters. He has the length and the quickness, and he can get around screens well enough to take a lot of that stuff away. And so to start with that kind of package and think, okay, the Pistons, you know, they tried him out in some pick and roll last season. They were trying to expand his game, do a little more ball handling. If he takes one more step this year, given that, you know, maybe it's just because of the situation he's in, or if you put him, transport him to another team and think about what he might do, you know, he really isn't that far off from being a really significant player. And so he's one of these guys who every year we're trying to identify a couple of candidates who are really prime to make a jump. And he was the guy who we liked to kind of take that next step to prove that he's not only a more solid 3-and-D type, but that he might also have some other streaks to his game.
So what concerns me about KCP is that the idea of KCP is awesome. Like, 3-and-D guy, young, super athletic. The problem is he can't really shoot threes, and his defense is, I mean, like, he sort of gets credit for being a great defender. Detroit's defense has never been very good.
Well, I would say that when we look at the vacuum test, there's a few black holes around the league. I'm looking at New York. I'm looking at Orlando. I'm looking at playing alongside Reggie Jackson. All of those things are
going to... We're going to get to Reggie Jackson, who somehow is 25 spots higher on this list than KCP.
So those kinds of things will warp perception after a down year for everybody. So, like, we have to look at all the Pistons and kind of just reimagine them as players, all these former Pistons. Obviously, KCP is now with the Lakers. We just thought if you put... KCP's skill set's very transferable. It would work in a lot of different places, and if he was playing with better players, he would look better. His three-point shot percentage would go up. He'd have easier shots. He wouldn't have to do quite as much maybe as he had to do in Detroit. And then defensively, you know, it's hard to maintain consistent defensive energy when you know Andre Drummond's the guy behind you, right?
Okay, but if you're trying to win this year, mm-hmm. I'm not even going to stand out for Dion Waiters too hard.
Oh, God.
But if you're no, we can look at some other snubs. Andre Roberson is more useful to a basketball team than KCP right now. And that's this year is about 2017.
Well, that was something that you said trying to sound smart, which I actually appreciate because I like Roberson a lot. I had a hard time leaving him off the list. Another guy like that is Kid Gilchrist, right?
Uh-huh.
What KCP does not do that is cripple your offense in the same way that those guys do. I mean, you really have to scheme around their lack of shooting. Teams will just completely ignore them. And in a playoff series, that would really show. KCP is not a great three-point shooter, but you can't just leave him wide open, stand 15 feet away from him, and just dare him to take any single shot that he wants. And I think that's sort of the difference there.
Okay. Moving on.
That's one thing that that Andrew brought up as well, is like the idea of Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. I think teams still guard him with that idea too. Like, I mean, he's not an awful three-point shooter. He came in at like 35% last year. But they still tend to guard him as if he's making that shot at a higher rate. And in some ways, that's even more valuable than doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair. I want to move on, though. D'Angelo Russell at number 100. I feel like you may have put him there to troll me personally.
We put him there because you complained so vociferously about Seth Curry being at number 100. Now, we were like, look, we can't have Seth Curry at 100. We have to snub Seth Curry. Let's put some player who might have a real ceiling and put up some numbers and maybe finally take a leap after two pathetic, terrible leadership-type seasons in L.A., and that's where we landed.
That's my thing, though, is if he's on this list at all, you're projecting him to get better. And the chances, if he does get better, the chances are pretty high that this is going to be way too low for him.
Well, he wasn't a top 250 guy last year, so this is a pretty
metric. Look, you have Elfrid Payton above him. You have Dennis Schroeder above him.
You just showed yourself there because we knew Elfrid Payton would be the one that would catch up to casual fans because they're just going to say non-shooter on a losing team and just dismiss him completely. And I think Rob can explain.
So
Elfrid does quite a bit, doesn't he, Rob?
I'll let Rob explain. I just want to say that I went through and sort of marked up the top 100 with a pen here, and my note next to Elfrid Payton is, I mean, dot, 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 what is happening here?
Okay.
So explain Elfrid Payton's place in the top 100.
Yeah, I mean, Payton is a guy who, since we're trying to evaluate these guys in a vacuum as much as possible, I think he really benefits from the fact that the Orlando Magic are just a miserable basketball organization right now. I mean, when you look at the lineups that he was in, you know, playing with, you know, two centers at the same time, Aaron Gordon at small forward, and still to make meaningful improvement to the point where he's now a pretty solid finisher around the rim, to the point where he's now shooting 47% from the field. And, like, he has that Rondo effect where teams want him to shoot, but the first step in becoming
Rondo
a better shooter
is
proving
really
that he can.
Damning. Yeah, so
look, he's not a guy I want on my team.
Yeah.
I will say that, but that's not the standard, right? Like, if we were only picking those guys, Cousins wouldn't even be on the list, right? Like, there's a certain degree where you have to say, all right, let's give him respect for what he can do. Good downhill guy, like Rob's saying, get to the basket, finish. He can collapse the defense. I think.
But we're talking vacuums here. If we're talking vacuums.
Well, if you give him average shooters and average space around him, he's going to look like a completely different player than he has in Orlando because they've had the worst spacing basically of any team in the league for the last three seasons.
But wouldn't you also agree that if Elfrid Payton is playing more than 25 minutes a game for your team is not in great shape?
No.
I mean, he doesn't shoot and needs the ball. And
no, but he can attack off the dribble. He can collapse the defense. He can set up, you know, the kind of zing, zing, zing passes around the perimeter. He's got good size. I think he would look, if they had better defensive pieces around him, they were kind of a mess defensively in terms of fit last year, too. I think he could be, you know, a pretty physical guy on the ball, guard multiple positions given his size. Look,
so
when you're in the top 100 here, just as a point of reference for you, that means you're basically top 20 to 25 at your position, right?
Right.
Which means you're in some cases, the bottom of the list, you're a below average starter. Elfrid Payton, guess what, is a below average starter.
But
I think a team
with Malcolm Brogdon is better off than they would be with Elfrid Payton.
Yeah, Malcolm Brogdon.
And same with Dion Waiters. Same with Jabari Parker. How did you leave Jabari Parker off the list?
Well, he has two ACL season-ending injuries in 3 years. He's out for a huge percentage of the season. He hasn't played defense yet. The Bucks didn't skip a beat when they lost him, and he really hasn't done anything besides score points for your fantasy team.
I would bet $500 that Jabari Parker is going to be more valuable than Elfrid Payton in 2017.
Based on what metrics? What do you use to quantify value? I will take all of your money, and you still owe me for last year.
I do. So Ben gave me, I think, 50-1 odds on Karl Towns MVP, and I owe him $50. But it was worth it for the chance, like, at 2,500.
I will agree with you that Jabari Parker, assuming he gets back on the court sometime this season, will average more points than Elfrid Payton. That's how you value players, it seems like.
Okay.
If we're talking about overall value,
that's
in
not
terms
how
of player efficiency, win shares,
no,
other
I think,
metrics that real plus minus, Elfrid Payton is going to beat
look, I'm
Jabari
not
Parker
gonna,
in
I'm
all
not
of
gonna,
those categories.
I'm not going to let you turn me into Mr. Fantasy Stats, casual fan. I value players by usage. If Elfrid Payton is a high usage guy for your team is screwed. And that's fine.
Well, I think you've got sort of a chicken and the egg thing going here. And I actually think we should push back against that because it's a trap I've fallen into with Elfrid Payton, too. You're saying the Magic suck, therefore Payton sucks. Well, actually, you're saying it the other way. Payton sucks, so therefore the Magic suck. And I think it's more of the opposite. I think that there's some institutional issues there in Orlando that are preventing Payton from looking as good as he could possibly
Well,
look.
You've been talking about the Magic spacing. The Magic spacing sucks because of Elfrid Payton.
No, not only Elfrid Payton. they
he
Aaron
bears
Gordon.
a lot of the blame.
Scouts told me when Aaron Gordon came out from the draft that they think he made more sense as a small ball five than a three. What did they start him at last season? The three. His numbers fell off a cliff. His efficiency didn't look nearly as good after they made the trade. Get rid of Ibaka. They put Gordon back to his normal position. Everybody starts to play better. Surprise, surprise. It's not that complicated. Do they have any shooters really to support Payton? I mean, yes, he needs a little bit of massaging.
Yes.
I'm not his number one fan here, but he is much better than he gets credit
for. You know what is the most frustrating part of the top 100 process for me? Is that you guys go so hard on these irrational positions that I have to then take up, like, standing for DeMar DeRozan or standing for the Orlando Magic. So you're not going to – I'm not going to be out here defending Frank Vogel and the Magic front office. I will just say that Elfrid Payton at 96 strikes me as odd, particularly because, like, Joe Ingles is super solid. Roberson, Brogdon, like, these are players that I think are a lot more useful. But we should move on because we're not going to spend the entire podcast arguing about Elfrid Payton.
Out of curiosity, do you know Joe Ingles' stats from last year?
No, but he was I guarantee you that his plus minus for Utah was pretty impressive and definitely better than Elfrid Payton. Let's move on to...
I'm with you on throwing Ben to the wolves on Joe Ingles, by the way.
He does love Joe Ingles, but, like, to a certain degree, like, if you're out there, you're not a full-time starter, and you're averaging 7-3. At what point do we say, okay, like, you are cool, like, you're a hipster, a basketball guy, people love you, but at 7-3, are you really that important?
Yeah. I think he may look better because of how badly the Jazz needed him last year.
Yeah.
But Marvin Williams at number 88. Explain yourself, Rob.
Marvin's a guy who I think it's very reasonable to look at his place or look at his, like, box score production and wonder, like, what does this guy do?
Uh-huh.
Because so much of his value comes down to, like, a fill the gaps, fill an exact kind of role on a winning team kind of mentality and kind of production, where there are only so many of these kind of tweener 3-4 types who, by the way, are, like, some of the most valuable defenders in the league right now,
right,
who are also kind of league average or better 3-point shooters. And so you're narrowing the field to that. On top of that, Williams is getting more and more comfortable with his in-between game, stepping in off that three, knocking down mid-range jumpers and floaters, kind of doing some things off the dribble that are a little more interesting. And so to have even just a touch of dynamism from that kind of role, which I think the entire league has shown how valuable it is.
Just a touch of dynamism with Marvin Williams.
Pretty important.
Yeah, okay. So why is he above James Johnson, though? I feel like James Johnson has
James Johnson had a touch more.
Well,
he had one good year in his entire career. He's never really done anything before last year.
Okay, and Marvin Williams had one good year, and it was 2 years ago.
No, he's had more than one good year. He's had a solid 3-year run.
I don't know. Last year was kind of underwhelming coming
off
the
contract. Well, he had a great
contract.
Career year. He did step back slightly, but his numbers didn't fall off that much. I think people were a little... they thought he was a little bit more inconsistent last year. Their team as a whole was disappointing, so I think that bled over to him a little bit. But, I mean, what we're wary of, and the James Johnson one's a good example, is, like, we got real caught up in the Damari Carroll hype, right? Like, you have that one random breakout in your late 20s or your mid-20s, and it's like, oh, wow, this guy's some crazy player. And we were just trying to be cautious with James Johnson and say, look, like, you know, you did it once, but you were also around here 5-6 years beforehand. You know, your role might change next season. Are you going to be able to repeat that now that you don't have the carrot of, the upcoming contract?
That's fair. That's fair to me. Yeah, I think Marvin Williams is solid. There are other guys that you got left off the top 100 entirely. That...
You just keep going back to Dion Waiters. So just try to make your case for a one-trick pony who hasn't mastered his trick, who wasn't healthy last season, who's never really contributed to a winner. I mean, let's make this case. Let's hear it.
Yeah, no, I don't really – I'm not gonna go too far. I loved your withering dismissals of Waiters in your little write-up. It was like if bluster was the deciding factor, Waiters would be perennial top 10. And yeah, one trick pony without a trick is pretty amazing. No, we're not gonna freak out about Waiters too much because I'm with you. He's an irrational confidence guy that I'm not even that confident in.
Well, can I say one point here? To just bring a level of, you know, lack of intensity because we're getting a little bit too at each other's throats here. I would just tend to disagree that the guys who are at the bottom of this list, there are all these candidates to replace them. I don't know if you agree, Rob, but I felt like this year the snubs part of it was actually easier than most years. Like I felt like we had maybe a hard time filling out 100 and not necessarily feeling like we left a whole bunch of deserving people off.
Yeah, I mean, I think there were five or six guys, and a lot of them we've already mentioned. It was the Joe Ingles. It was the Andre Robertson. It was guys who like have one-way games but are kind of tricky to place. But it wasn't as deep a crop as usual. And, I mean, I think the Dion Waiters hype kind of speaks to that, where it is truly depressing how much I've heard about Dion Waiters this week, given that we left him off this list. You would think 15 inefficient points per game in half a season was a goddamn revelation, but apparently, I don't know. This is what the people want these days.
Waiters also only played about 35 games.
That's what we're saying.
So, fair enough.
Unbelievable.
I think if you put like Jabari, that 88 would be a good spot for Jabari Parker. Like it's safe. Mm-hmm. If he comes back healthy, he's going to be more valuable than that. And 88 reflects the fact that you don't know how healthy he's going to
be. If we put Jabari Parker on the list, you're going to just come back next year and say, Chandler Parsons, Derek Favors, all these guys with injury issues. You should have known they had injury issues. It's all you do. You cherry pick the injured guys.
Chandler Parsons was injured when you ranked him 50th.
He's injured right now. That's why we left him off.
Yeah. You don't hear me crying out for more Parsons on this list. All right. So you talked about Marvin Williams and how valuable he is positionally. But then you also have like Robin Lopez here. And Robin Lopez is pretty solid, but I'm not sure how useful he is at this point in his career.
We had a hard time with a lot of these centers because if you're not a guy who covers a lot of ground, if you're not one of these guys who can play a small ball five in a playoff series, the immediate instinct is, well, that guy's value is now like 20% less because he can just get played off the court. So it's not even just Lopez. It's a guy who's really talented like Jonas Valanciunas.
Yeah.
A lot of those guys we really had to rethink this year, and it's like, well, if you're not a plus defender – and your big skill is scoring, or you're just solid, like you're an all-around guy like Lopez, would teams just rather have an extra stretch four, you know, like a shot-blocking four? And yeah, it's tough. I mean, again, it goes back to Lopez is fairly far down the list. You know, is he a below-average starting center? Yeah, I think he is. So he has a place here still. But he's a guy who kind of needs a lifeline, though, don't you think? Like this coming season, like he's probably going to look worse than he actually is just because of his current situation and fit.
Yeah, well, I think he's a trade candidate. But I also, you think through like what teams would really benefit from a Robin Lopez trade, and that list is not very long.
There still is a role for those guys, though. I mean, a lot of those big guys, they'll start, they'll fill minutes. It's sort of like the Bogut role.
It's like a warm body.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, well, yeah, we got to save our best lineups for the fourth quarter. But yeah, I don't know. Rob, do you have any other thoughts on the centers?
I mean, two things. I guess one, this range in particular, I think we tend to favor those kinds of solid guys. And like Marvin factors into that as well, where there are obviously higher upside candidates than Marvin and Robin Lopez. But what those guys give you on a nightly basis to us was pretty valuable, especially when one of the really hard kind of criteria to wrestle with was, okay, how would this guy do like in a series against the Warriors, in which so much of the league is just completely defunct? So obviously, if you have that kind of opposition, Lopez is pretty useless. Like what he does not translate to that context. But when we're trying to evaluate, okay, it's not just can he be on a championship team, but could he help push a playoff team further? Could he help get a team into the playoffs? Could he help make a terrible team less terrible? And that's the kind of area where Lopez really does help quite a bit, just because he's such a steady force, one of the better and more disruptive defenders at the rim, without even really having to jump just because he's so big. And on top of that, like these really low usage, low maintenance bigs who are just going to scoop in offensive rebounds and give you, you know, 10 to 12 points a night is kind of an important thing when if you're going to value the Russell Westbrooks of the world who can just drive and pile up points and be, you know, huge usage players, you have to also value the guys who are going to fit in alongside that. And Lopez is one of those guys.
You know, you actually kind of sold me there.
Yeah, no, it's great because...
Yeah, the garbage man. No, you need a garbage man.
I just love that Rob's in here dropping knowledge so that I don't feel like it's just me lecturing you all the time.
I appreciate it. And I also, it's hard because you're talking about the 100 best players. And, like, Robin Lopez is better at what he does than a lot of the, quote-unquote, like, the wings. Like, he's better than Evan Fournier.
Yeah.
But I wonder whether he's more useful than a guy like Evan Fournier would be.
No, and usefulness is definitely something that we look at. Like,
yeah.
We hope that this list reflects that. I mean, like you mentioned the top 10, like someone like Draymond Green. There are people out there who would say Draymond Green has no business being in the top 10. I'm sure he was a polarizing pick being 10th, right? Usefulness and adaptability, versatility, and then being able to do it for, you know, again, in a vacuum with any group of teammates goes a long, long way.
He's a defensive cheat code, basically. All right. Tobias Harris is someone who I have no use for as a basketball player.
Yeah, you mentioned that last week. Why? Why are you so down on him?
Well, no, I just like he's another guy where like if you're counting on him for 30 minutes a game, you're probably going to end up being disappointed, and you have a bigger problem. Like he's just good enough to feel like he's a solution, and he is just limited enough to be damning in the long run. And I think the Pistons are sort of finding that out now.
Yeah, Rob, I'm curious because I did a bunch of the Pistons blurbs and I came out a little bit higher than I thought going in on Tobias. I mean, I think he's in position, depending on how Reggie plays next season, to be their leading scorer. I mean, I think it's a classic conundrum where, like, he's definitely a plus guy on offense, a minus guy on defense, and it's this constant balance of, like, how do you find the right role for him? Who do you pair him with? What lineup combinations do you use to kind of get the most out of him while also covering up his faults? I think Stan struggled with that a little bit last year, used him in different roles. But now that you look at all the turnover the Pistons roster has had, I think he has to go back to Tobias and really empower that guy. And
good luck with that.
Well, you know? What are his options? I mean, look, I'm not. That's why I'm saying, how down are we on Detroit? I mean, he's one of their best scoring options. I think it's him or Reggie. That's what they've got.
Yeah, well, and Reggie at 78 and Schroeder at 76. I just these are players who I don't think are very good.
Yeah.
And
well, Reggie was terrible last year. Reggie wasn't a top 200 player last year. He had a lot of injury issues. I think we're now in the situation with Reggie where at his best, he wasn't that bad. You know, like 2 years ago, he had a career year. He wasn't fantastic, but he is right around that league average starting point guard level, right? He has a terrible year. You want to give him a second chance. If he's just done, even though he's, you know, not even close to being 30 yet, then he will be off next year. But you don't want to completely preemptively write him off as a player if he's able to reclaim the status that he was at 2 years ago. It's not like the game has changed that much for a player. His skills are still basically the same. He just did a terrible job finishing last year because he didn't have his athleticism and confidence. His shot wasn't there. And then I think I don't want to say people hate him, but like it doesn't seem like he's...
Yeah,
like,
it should be a strike against him that teammates seem to loathe Reggie Jackson.
And I think that we've factored that in. You know?
Yeah. I think we'll get to March and D'Angelo Russell will look like a much better player than either Reggie Jackson or Dennis Schroeder. But
yeah, you've been telling us that about Russell for 3 years.
True. Fair enough. All right. So,
no, but actually, that's completely plausible.
Yeah.
I mean, that is possible. Again, we're not saying who's best case scenario. We're just trying to say,
but look, that's your responsibility. You're ranking these guys for the upcoming year. You should be accounting for March.
I have accounted for every month between now and June.
Okay. Rob, which one of you is responsible for ranking Cody Zeller above Dwight Howard?
Ben and I actually held hands and jumped off that cliff together. you can't tear us apart. There's nothing you can do to convince us that Dwight Howard is a better player than Cody Zeller right now.
Really? This is another one where, like, look, I'm not a Dwight Howard fan, and you're not going to turn me into a Dwight Howard apologist, but he was very solid in Atlanta last year.
And people love Dwight, too, right?
Yeah, he's another one who's going to win every popularity contest. But he's very solid and should bounce back under Steve Clifford, which I know you're not talking about vacuums here, but He's going to start ahead of Cody Zeller and will likely be more valuable this year in Charlotte. So explain yourself.
There's kind of two things. There's two things juxtaposed for us. One, the Hornets just imploded when Zeller went out with injury, and even when he was off the floor, especially their defense, which is the best thing that they do. So that's kind of one piece of evidence that we look at, especially when Dwight and Cody are really two similarly rolled players, with the exception being that Cody Zeller actually does all the stuff that you want Dwight Howard to do. When you talk about a guy who's like, just pick and roll already, like just do a minimal thing and do it very well, and Zeller is exactly that kind of player. And the other piece of evidence was that Mike Boonholzer, who's a very smart basketball mind and coach, decided that Mike Muscala was like, a better basketball player than Dwight Howard in the playoffs.
Yeah, that's fair.
The other thing, too, I'd say is we think Zeller should be the starter there. And, like, we were going back and forth on this and, like, okay, of course Dwight's the vet. Like, you're probably going to have to pay him respect and try to keep him engaged by starting him to start the season. But, like, when we're looking at their best five-man units, how do you really want to roll out there? Zeller's pretty darn good. He's one of the most underrated players, huge impact. Not ever going to be a star anywhere on the close to the level of where Dwight was. But if you're saying who's going to close games for the Hornets in the playoffs, we just saw, like Rob mentioned, Dwight didn't for Atlanta. There's no really reason to believe he's going to in Charlotte should they make the first round, and Zeller definitely could.
Don't you think Dwight has a bigger defensive impact than Zeller ever will?
Right now, but yes. I think, again, if you're getting into a playoff battle where everybody's going small, Dwight won't. That's why he's off the court. He can't keep up. He can't run around. He's not the same guy athletically. He's going to put up big rebounding numbers for you. He can still definitely be the center on an elite defense like we saw last year. But he's also – that comes with baggage. He wants the ball. He wants touches. He wants to break up your offense, and Zeller doesn't.
This is one of those things where I think both of you guys are wrong, but I also don't care enough to really protest. but the thing I do care about is 64 through 60. Devin Booker at 64 is about 20 spots too low.
You said that last year, and we were right.
No, I was right last year. Last year, Devin Booker was last year's D'Angelo Russell. He was number 100.
But he wasn't. He didn't outplay his ranking.
All right, fine. Devin Booker should have been like 80 last year. But 64 for Devin Booker still feels low, in part because, look, if you flip him and put him on the Kings, who George Hill is 63, 62 is Trevor Ariza, 61 is Ricky Rubio. If you put him in Utah this year, Utah has a much – well, it's the West is murder, but Utah has a higher ceiling at that point.
Nah.
They didn't hit his explosiveness.
He has once – actually, I want Rob to lecture you on this because I think Rob is a passionate Devin Booker hater, and it's lurking right below the surface. So, Rob, channel your angriest you're like your Halloween persona and bring it out here.
Devin Booker has one skill that happens to be the most important skill you can have in today's NBA. Go ahead,
Rob. Just not efficiently. Like, he's really good at taking the shots. Like, he's really good at shooting. Not necessarily making, but shooting. He's great at shooting.
He had a rough first half shooting last year, and then it picked up, and he was awesome.
So a rough first year and a half shooting. And
when
then
he was 19 and 20 years old. So, God damn it. All right, go ahead, Rob.
I mean, to me, 64 is kind of a gift. And like, especially when you're comparing him to proven veteran guys, the contrast is just so stark to me, it's unbelievable. I mean, he's a guy who has been said, like, it's very funny when you listen to, you know, people will bring out the stats of like, oh, he's the first player at his age to do this, or he's one of three players at his age to do that. And they're pretty much all usage related. It's like, he's the first player to hit this point threshold. Well, yeah, he's shooting 18 times a game. How many players age 20 have ever done that?
So
or have ever hit his level of usage?
So you're better off with Ricky Rubio, who will dribble for the first 16 seconds of the shot clock and then get caught in a corner and pass it to somebody who's not in a position to score.
And then average 9 assists a game and play elite on-ball defense?
I mean,
I understand. Like, you only think it's about scoring.
No.
We're trying to explain to you basketball is about more than that.
God, fuck off. I don't think it's about scoring. I think a guy like Rubio really limits what you could do offensively. And we saw that in Minnesota.
Yeah, look.
Talk about Dwight.
Even when they were a top 10 offense last year?
No, but they could not close games for 6 months straight. And that was, I expect them to get a lot better in Rubio's absence.
Yeah, Phoenix was awesome closing games last year.
Yeah, I mean, they couldn't open games for 6 months straight. They won 24 games last season.
Look, I need you... I need you to defend Trevor Ariza on this list also. Shot 30. I actually looked it up. This was probably the worst choice you guys made this year. Trevor Ariza at 62. Shot 34% from three last year. Yeah. Averaged 11 points a game. I could have averaged 11 points a game for the Rockets last year.
What is the greatest ability?
Availability? What?
Bingo. He's played 80-plus games 3 years in a row. When you're talking about guys you want locked in next to a superstar like Harden who aren't going to, you know, like Patrick Beverley potentially, make a trade demand because of personality issues or whatever else it might be, who are just going to play the role, do it solidly, take the big defensive responsibilities, knock down the three-point shots, stand in the corner, not try to do too much, be solid for a winning team. It's not an accident that they've been really good during this stretch. He just fits perfectly. And he also, again, transferable. Put him on any winning team, you can plug him in. If you don't have an elite three, plug Trevor Ariza in. He's going to give it to you.
Rob, so continue on Devin Booker. I'm going to give you one more chance to convince me. I really am not sold that he doesn't help a lot. Like, Phoenix, you talk about, I mean, you guys are giving points to Elfrid Payton for being held back by Orlando.
Yeah.
Like,
sure.
Marquese Chris is like a basketball infant and was playing 30 minutes a game toward the end of the year. TJ Warren missed 2 months for the Suns. Mm-hmm. Like, Booker was surrounded by trash.
Look, we don't want to put anyone who has never played a meaningful NBA game on the top 100. That's why Rob said it's a gift that he's 64.
Okay. But, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what to say.
So here's
this
the thing.
No, history will prove me right.
Think about it this way, because you were trying to do the let's imagine Booker in this scenario. If you put Booker on one of these elite teams right now, he is not a starter. He is not a number one or a number two option. So now what is he contributing to games next season on a good team if he's not taking 18 shots a game? What's he doing? He's giving you big time minus defense. He's giving you so-so playmaking for others. And that's it. So he's not starting. You know, for the Warriors, he's the eighth man. You know?
No, you talk about somebody who could hang against the Warriors, which, like, to go back to something Rob said, I think that's a kind of an unfair test because
Is he going to start?
Most of the league couldn't.
Well, I'm just saying no. Like,
but I think he could.
Is Booker going to start for Houston? No. They're going to start Ariza over him. Better fit. He's not as good at scoring. He's not as good as ball handling as the
elite guys.
Is
Booker close for Houston?
No.
Probably, yeah.
Nah. No.
Yeah.
Because he's given up too many points on the other end.
I don't know.
I mean, here's the thing is if you're going to be primarily a scorer and that's where the lion's share of your value lies, and especially with Booker, who is probably one of the worst big minute defenders in the league, then you have to be really, really good at it. And he's pretty good in volume, but there are guys, if you're looking for guys who are going to shoot 18 times a game, you're going to find much better ones. And they're also better defenders and they also make their teammates better and they're also better passers and they're also not league average 3-point shooters.
But Rob, he scored 70 points in a game though.
Look, I would have been happy if Devin Booker were above Trevor Ariza and Ricky Rubio, and then it was basically it's Booker, George Hill, Trevor Ariza, Rubio, Drew Holiday. I can accept that he's not at Drew Holiday or George Hill's level. Rubio and Ariza are not a no-go for me. But fair enough. Agree to disagree. You guys could be wrong. And one thing I had a problem with is the 50s, to me, looked better than the 40s.
Okay.
And to take one example would be Avery Bradley at 54. I would rather have Avery Bradley than Harrison Barnes, 49.
He's from Seattle, right?
Batum, he's from Tacoma.
Okay, so there you go.
Doesn't really rock with the Seattle players, though. Nicholas Batum, Steven Adams, Andre Iguodala. I think Avery Bradley is more useful than all those guys. And Iguodala is tough because he's in like the perfect situation where he's super valuable to Golden State. But as you guys say ad nauseum, we're talking about in a vacuum here.
Well, Rob, maybe this is a good opportunity to speak about the value of multi-positional defenders when they can guard, say, like two threes and fours rather than ones and twos with Bradley. Because I think what we would agree with Sharp on is that, like, Bradley's an elite backcourt guard. You'd love to have him, especially if you have a lead ball handler on offense, because he can pick up the tough defensive slack while still helping out as a secondary option on offense. So we definitely like Bradley. There's no doubt about it. But we kind of have a preference for those wing guys who are switching and interchangeable, right?
Yeah, and a lot of that comes down to, you know, like Bradley will make your life easier if you have an Isaiah Thomas or a Stephen Curry. If you want somebody to guard an opposing point guard, he's a really useful guy to have around. But when you're talking about kind of Jay Crowder types, or as we get higher up, like Chris Middleton types, these guys who can guard 2-4 or even 1-4 in certain matchups, you're empowering your team to put their best players on the floor. Because when you have that level of flexibility, then you can actually build your best lineups and you can adapt to a wider variety of situations. And so, I mean, we think Bradley is really good. That's why he's the 54th best player in the league. But I don't think it's a slight to say that there are some limitations that kind of keep him from moving up.
He's also higher in our heart. We're with you. We like Bradley. Like I think sure. The line that I used last year with Bradley was like, there should be more people in the world like Avery Bradley, more NBA players in the world like Avery Bradley, because that's a great mold. Like, yeah. There's going to be all these guys like the D'Angelo Russells of the world who are coming up, who are going to have the ball in their hands, who want to be that lead guy. And if you can play off these AAU-style lead guards and really help on offense and through all sorts of little ways, and also building up a three-point shot and then just be an absolute dog on defense, that's an awesome player. And that should become a bigger mold than it is. And there's not as many guys in that same mold as you would think.
That's my thing, is yeah. There's a lot of – we talk about 3-and-D guys, mm-hmm. and there are only a few guys who really live up to the hype in that department. And Bradley is a shutdown guy who then allows you to space the floor on offense. And
health issues too is one other thing that we should probably mention in terms of like where we're putting him is, you know,
yeah,
he's not giving you 3,000 minutes a year.
But like Batum is a guy who, you know, 2 years ago was great. Last year, not so much.
Yeah, I mean,
basically every Hornet is I'm down on.
There's a couple of teams like that, and it's a thing that we go through with this exercise, is you don't want to overreact to that down year, because usually the truth is somewhere in the middle, right? Like you're saying, maybe we overrated Marv Williams a little bit last year. Maybe we underrate him a little bit this year. You know, you want to kind of try to strike the balance. And Batum, he has a level of playmaking for his teammates and facilitating for his teammates that a guy like Bradley just doesn't have. I mean, and not very many players at his position have. If you look at the other guys who are averaging like 5 rebounds, 5 assists in a game, it's all NBA guys. Batum is like totally unique as one of these wings who's a true secondary playmaker for others. And so, you know, is it ideal? Like, could their offense be better? Yeah. But when you have complete non-shooters that they're trying to work around, guys like Kid Gilchrist, Cody Zeller can't shoot the three, some of these other guys who are maybe crowding your spacing, having a creative passer in Batum in that front court to help set up Kemba Walker is very valuable.
Yeah. I think my biggest objection in the 40s, well, I have two, actually. Gallinari is this year's Parsons Award winner, not going to be healthy for the entire year, has no business being this high. And then Jay Crowder, man, I'm a Jay Crowder fan. Mm-hmm. I really like him for a lot of the reasons that Rob mentioned. He allows you to play some versatile lineups, stretches the floor, and can guard a little bit. But I think we might be overstating his defensive impact. And he's also doesn't stretch the floor as well as people think. So having him at 44 above guys, like, again, we're supposed to be projecting. I don't think that Jay Crowder is going to be a better player than Otto Porter will be this year. I don't think he's going to be better than Andrew Wiggins. I don't think he's going to be better than Gary Harris, all guys in the 50s. J.J. Redick is another one who could have been a little bit higher. So defend Crowder for me.
I mean, Crowder and Bradley are kind of linked in an interesting way, where a lot of kind of the bigger picture defensive metrics with the Celtics assess a lot more credit to Crowder than they do Bradley. And I think some of that underrates Bradley, where there's clearly something going on. When you watch him, you can see a lot of his value, and for some reason it isn't translating. It kind of is a little bit of a concern, though, that the Celtics were a better defensive team with him off the floor. And so, you know, some of that's a good defender, the lineups around him, what have you. There is a part of so many of you know, what Boston, so much of what Boston was able to do well. Cleveland's going to spotlight a lot of those there, again, the versatility of a player like that, I think he's just better defensively than you're giving him credit for there. And he shot nearly 40% on threes last season, which he's really living up to. As you said, there aren't a lot of guys who are really fulfilling the 3-and-D kind of mantle, and he's right there in both regards, doing both things at a really high level. I think most of what's been held against him defensively is that he can't guard LeBron James, to which he can join 99% of the league, I guess. I mean, he definitely can't do that. But otherwise, he's a really smart and strong all-around player who we like based on the positions that he puts your team in.
Did you guys argue about this at all?
Oh, and here's what's really annoying, though, is because once the Warriors sweep the Cavaliers and Crowder can't guard Kevin Durant, Sharp's going to come back and say, I told you I was right. Crowder's terrible. And he's going to disregard the fact that Crowder's got like a plus 12 net rating for the season.
I'm not saying he's terrible. He's just not this good. You guys overvalue players who are good in their role and undervalue upside.
Okay. Well, whatever. I actually think a more interesting conversation we should have right now is the fact that I am having regrets for once about one of our players.
Okay.
And it's Gallinari. And Rob is a Gallinari basically PR slash, I mean, I don't know exactly how to say it, because you pretty much brainwash me on Gallinari every single year, Rob. So do it again so that we can explain why we got to where we are with Gallo, given some of the injury issues that he's had in the past, the injury issue he had this summer, new role, new team. I mean, why is he where he is?
Okay, first of all, if you end up missing games for punching somebody in the face, you're moving up our list on Moxie alone. That's a nice feather in your cap.
That's fair. So you're speaking my language.
Yeah, we finally got one that Sharp can agree with. This is perfect.
Unbelievable reason to be injured, presumably at the start of the season, but hopefully he'll be healthy by then. I mean, Gallo is one of these guys who I don't even think people realize as they're watching him just how effective a scorer he is. He's the only player in the league who is one of the three best pick-and-roll scorers and best post-up scores in terms of efficiency. And he's doing that because he just draws fouls at this ridiculous rate. And so that does subject him to, you know, there's some fishy business involved with what he does, but he's so damn good at it in terms of making the most of every possession that he gets that he ends up being this really important kind of secondary scorer for a team. And if you can be that good in that kind of role where you're able to play off of, you know, really a team-oriented offense like they had in Denver last season, find this role where you're very effective in it and also contribute defensively. And I think, you know, you could argue that he really hasn't been playing enough at his best position yet, which is power forward. So if you put him in that spot, he's going to be fulfilling what you want out of a stretch four. He shot 39% from three last year. He's going to be scoring in this wide variety of ways that is really tough to guard just because there aren't a lot of guys who are quick enough to guard a 6'10 dude who can take them off the dribble and who's always looking to get them in trouble with fouls. He's just a really tough cover and a guy who can at least compete defensively and play a really high leverage position as kind of a stretchy power forward.
He's a walking mismatch. I mean, he's tough. He puts a lot of pressure on your lineups. I'm now fully back to being brainwashed. I mean, I
heard stretch four, and you know how a lot of times us on the internet will sort of like place guys into that stretch four role, whereas actual players are like, there's a lot of wear and tear that you accrue over the course of a year playing up a position, and I don't see that working out well with Gallo.
Yeah, it's tricky because he is not what we think of when we say stretch four. When we think of stretch four, we think Ryan Anderson just bombing away.
Yeah.
And Gallo is a dynamic all-around offensive player who, like I said, is a matchup nightmare and really creates issues for people.
Can't really guard anybody.
No. Like Rob said, he competes defensively. He's got some length. He can move his feet a little bit. He's better than a lot of the prototypical quote-unquote stretch fours who were just riding off completely as defensive
players. I'm a fan. I've just gotten sucked into Gallinari hype for the last like 5 years, and every year his teams don't win, and he usually misses 20 or 30
games.
Well,
here's my secret. Once he does that again next year, just blame Rob.
Okay, I will. I'm going to remember this. I'm curious about Embiid with you guys because he's a guy who I think even if he played 65 games would have top 30 value. You have him at 41 behind Isaiah. So they are obviously the two biggest injury question marks on this list. What do you think about Embiid, though?
Let me grab.
I mean, how much did you talk about it, really?
Well, so with Embiid, I think that we were in the top 20 to top 25 range for him, if healthy. Like, if we're giving him 75 games or if we're giving him 70 games, You know, he's got to be, I would say, above a guy like Jokic just in terms of his all-around impact. And he's challenging guys like Cousins and Marc Gasol. I mean, the elite centers, guys like DeAndre Jordan, like, he's in that conversation. When he was on the court last year, their defense was amazing. And he's a great all-around offensive threat. He has got three-point range. He's got a little dream shake to him. He can dunk through traffic. Confident, gets to the free throw line. I mean, sort of everything you want. And I think we should also give him some leadership points too. I mean, I think he's got that kind of personality where guys will rally around him. And, you know, certainly I'm not just saying that because he hugged TJ McConnell very aggressively, but that was a fun moment. So he's got a lot going for him, but you just can't say he's going to play 75 games when he's only played 31. I mean, he's averaged 10.3 games.
It's really tricky
over the last 3 years. That is the track record that we have to work with. And if he wants to outplay this, go for it. But you can't just grant it to him.
Yeah, it's tough because we had like a 6 week window where he was amazing. And
yeah, do you remember him in April though?
No.
What'd you think in December?
No.
He hasn't played 30 minutes and he hasn't played a back to back.
I'm not criticizing you guys. He's where he belongs. Maybe even a little high considering the injuries. But he's sort of the biggest riddle in the top 50 because if healthy, he's as valuable as anybody. Rob, I'm just curious, not to get us too far off track, but would you pay him a max extension the next month?
I would be scared out of my mind. And some of that's, I mean, just the things we've been talking about, you know, like Andrew, you said, even if he plays 65 games next season, and I mean, yeah, that's double what he's played in 3 years. I would be very tentative about it. And, you know, if other people want to come with the offers, I'll match, you know, some very competitive offers, certainly.
Yeah.
But in terms of getting ahead of that with an extension, it's like every month of information I have about Embiid's health is helpful to me. And yeah, he's kind
another
of
opportunity
that point where, like,
for
I'm
him
just
to...
not taking anything for granted in terms of his availability.
Yeah, and every month is another opportunity for him to submarine his value by getting injured again, you know? And I think, like, imagine if they had, like, during the middle of that six-week stretch, the Sixers front office probably like, oh, this is a no-brainer decision this summer. 1 month later, it's like, no. good thing we didn't sign that deal during the middle, right? And I think that's sort of the reality with him is they should let this play out until next year. He's got to prove it. He's got to understand that he has to prove it. And if he doesn't feel an obligation to live up to the money they've already paid him and he wants to be upset about it, I mean, I don't think he would. But usually guys who play that well on that level just think, okay, give me the money, I've earned it, right? And I don't think he's nearly in that position yet. If I'm Philadelphia, I think that only hamstrings you. It doesn't solidify your future like usually, like say like the John Wall move or the Bradley Beal move for Washington. That solidified their next 5 years. Paying Embiid and having him get hurt this season is the opposite effect of that. You know, that would be sort of the worst case scenario. And so for them, I would just punt it until next
season. Well, and the Wizards, it was scary trying to pay Bradley Beal, but they had no other option. And I think that's what'll happen with Philly is they're going to have to just sort of hold their nose and hope for the best. And when you think about it from a macro perspective, there isn't real, like, the plan right now and the blueprint sort of falls apart if you take Embiid out of the equation. Yeah. So
don't commit early.
Don't commit early, but really there's either way, there is no, it's sort of back to square one if he's not in the mix.
One other thing, you mentioned Isaiah being at 40 and being a tough injury guy. He was like late 20s for us.
I know. I told you guys
healthy.
To move him down.
What do you mean?
Well, when you emailed out for submissions, I put Isaiah sad face, move him down.
Oh, after the injury. Yeah. So originally before we kind of realized he was going to miss half the year, he was sort of in that late 20s range. He was a little bit behind Kyrie to kind of reflect, you know, the trade value. But if he's going to miss half a season, it's sort of the same calculation as with Embiid. It's like both those guys are all-star caliber players when they're healthy. But you know, how helpful can you be to an organization for a whole season if you're missing 40 games?
Yeah. So, Rob, I'm going to let you make your Chris Middleton case now.
Yes.
Because you have... You were so close. You guys were so close to nailing it with DeRozan. He should be 35. He should not be higher than Whiteside, Porzingis, Beal. But putting him below Middleton is a bridge too far for me. So make your case.
Okay. I mean, to me, they're really the same case, which is everything that you would want DeMar DeRozan to do that he doesn't, Chris Middleton does well. Okay, DeMar isn't a good three-point shooter. Chris Middleton is a 40-plus percent three-point shooter pretty much every season. DeMar isn't a good perimeter defender. Chris Middleton is one of the league's best perimeter defenders and a really competitive and good defender at power forward as well, if that's what you're into. And for a guy who, you know, okay, DeMar isn't a great passer out of double teams, doesn't read the floor always in the most efficient way. Middleton's one of the better playmaking wings in the league. Almost all of his assists go directly into dunks and layups and threes. And so he's really, you know, he's a secondary playmaker more than I think people understand. A guy who can do stuff off the dribble, but who's absolutely perfectly tailored to his role. And he's being dragged down a little bit in terms of his reputation because of injury, but that dude limped through the playoffs, gamed the hell out of that series to the best that he could, and I think really put up a competitive showing in terms of what he could do against teams that have good wing players and have a lot of things, a lot of players for him to defend. I mean, we're really high on Chris Middleton, obviously. We know that a lot of the world isn't going to come along for that ride. But, I mean, you talk to people from teams, they put him in more of a Klay Thompson echelon than they do a DeMar DeRozan echelon, if that makes sense. These guys who are perfect team players who are going to fit so well along one or two or three other stars. And those are the kinds of, like, highly versatile, high-leverage players that we tend to favor, is guys who can fit on a wide variety of teams. And Middleton is absolutely that.
Yeah.
So, Rob, I know you did the media junket up in Toronto that accompanies every single one of these releases, because DeMar will come out and, you know, take his shots about his ranking, and then the Toronto media loses their mind. I think if we're talking thirstiest local media groups, I think Toronto might be top two or three in the league. How would you grade the outrage this year on a 1 to 10 scale? I mean, I think last year was a certified 10 in terms of DeRozan being at 46 and their fans just losing their mind, melting down all over us. From the interviews that you've done up in Toronto, how much pushback did you get? How much, you know, were they patting you on the back for the fact that DeRozan moved up this year, or was it still anger?
I think it's still like a 7.5 to 8. I think on some level they kind of expect it at this point, which is probably good for all of us involved. I mean, we just aren't the biggest DeMar DeRozan fans, and so the sooner the people get that, I think it's going to be better for everybody.
Look, let me compliment you guys. You guys have made a lot of concessions this year. You've moved up players that I like more, and
we didn't make a single concession.
No, you have.
No, we have not made any concessions.
This year's list.
On an annual process, taking into account all information.
You got
a few things right. You got a few. I would say more than a few things wrong, and we made our adjustments independent of your opinion.
I know that deep in your heart, you wanted to have Melo in the 50s, and you didn't because he belongs in the 30s, and I appreciate that. I feel like I've rubbed off on you, Ben, over then, you sort of transferred it to Rob. You've done a good job, and you just needed one for you. And Chris Middleton as a top 35 player is one for you. And that's, I get it. I get it. It's the hipsters in you needed to pretend that he is, like, I would take Avery Bradley over Chris Middleton.
Yeah, you're losing a lot of basketball games with what you've said so far on this podcast, because you take Devin Booker over everybody.
Look, Middleton is really good. I think this is another case where he's very good at being a third option, whereas on some level, it depends on what type of team you're trying to build. If you're trying to build a title team, Middleton makes a lot more sense as a third or fourth option. But if you're talking about who's the best players, I think DeRozan is more productive.
Man, he's a better scorer. That's it. Every other category, Middleton is better at him.
But,
and who's more transferable? If you're talking about the very best teams, if you're Cleveland, would you rather have DeRozan or Middleton? No doubt about it, they want DeRozan.
DeRozan spent 6 months last year closing games for a team that won, I think, like 51 games in Toronto. That counts. Okay?
Their offensive efficiency was terrible. There's so many better ways to do it.
It matters that at the end of a game, you can throw the ball to DeRozan and he can get you a bucket. You can't do that with Chris Middleton. And that's been an issue in
Milwaukee
for
3 years. You'll be winning
by
15 points if you've got Middleton and as much talent as he has around him in Toronto.
The Bucks aren't winning any games by 15 points.
Because they don't have as much overall talent. If you put them in a vacuum and you say, okay, who's choose up sides. Or if you put them both on a great team like Golden State or Cleveland, Middleton's playing way more minutes. DeMar's not even seeing the court.
If you give Giannis DeRozan this year, the Bucks will have a more successful regular
season. No, they'd be
worse.
Their offense would be worse. Their defense would be significantly worse. It's not even close.
God damn it.
Please, Rob, please explain.
This is getting bad, guys. This is getting bad. All I can think about is how much better the Raptors would be with Chris Middleton. That's all I can think about right now.
Do you really believe that?
I really believe that. I mean, if you look at, basically the only argument against this kind of line of thinking is how well the Raptors did when Kyle Lowry was injured, and the fact that DeRozan had to carry that weight.
And then you look at the teams
they played against, and it's like Knicks, Pistons, injured Mavericks, Nets. It's just like the worst teams in the league.
It's the same reason why you voted for Westbrook, because he gets these amazing wins against lottery.
That's bullshit. I watched him in a must-win game against the Wizards.
You watched one game?
Beat the Wizards. No, he was really solid.
All right.
Look, DeRozan, you guys are too hard on him. I understand that.
Okay, so explain to me, how does ESPN have him lower than we do if we're too hard on him?
I can't explain ESPN's trolling this year. They were going hard. They ranked Lonzo Ball the 63rd best player in the league. So I'm not here to defend ESPN's rankings. I'm sure it was hard for you to see yourselves get out-trolled on DeRozan.
It was pretty annoying to get outflanked by anybody. But no, I think that you're giving DeRozan like this superhero credit for Toronto's success when he wasn't even close to their best player last year overall. That's Lowry. Still, it's not even close. And the Raptors play so much better when Lowry's on the court without DeRozan than they play when DeRozan's on the court without Lowry. Like, the numbers are absolutely overwhelming. And so when you're looking at that 51 win total, you have to give a lion's share of the credit to that for Lowry. And we also have to think about sustainability. The way DeRozan does it, it's hard, you know, year after year. He has done it for 1 year. He had one big career year. He has scaled up here these last couple of years. Last year was his best year. There's no question about it. Are you ready to guarantee to me right now he is going to have the same scoring number and same shooting number next year as he did last year?
Basically, the biggest strike—
is he going to regress?
The biggest strike against DeRozan is that he relies heavily on officiating and getting to the line.
Well, and he doesn't play defense,
and
he doesn't show up in the postseason. There's a lot of strikes against this guy.
Show up in the postseason in part because that officiating does not extend to the postseason. Yeah. But Chris Middleton, spoiler alert, Chris Middleton's not doing shit in the postseason at any point in his career.
He will this year.
Okay.
The Bucks will win a playoff series. And by the way, this is hilarious because you're trying to tear down Chris Middleton and you missed the only real argument against him, which is that he was injured last year. And that is the best reason to knock him down. If we have him too high, it's because he wasn't healthy enough last season.
Okay.
Well,
look.
One other DeRozan note, too. I mean, we're looking at 5 straight years of data that says the Raptors were better with him off the floor. Like, 5 years. And that's because they had, in part, one of the best benches in the league.
He gets all his bench players paid.
He couldn't even make those bench lineups good. Like what Kyle Lowry was doing with the same exact group of players, that was what translated to the Raptors being a good team. And
yeah.
So, look, he's a really impressive player. He's technically awesome. Like, I love watching him play in terms of his footwork and his technique. There's just a clear limit on how good a team can be if he is a prime offensive piece. And he has shown that he can't, because of the limits of his game, be more of a complimentary piece because he doesn't cut and he doesn't shoot threes.
He doesn't even start in the show.
Yeah, well,
he's in the Western Conference, he's not a starter. On any of the good playoff teams, if you're looking at his all-around game, he's not a starter.
Utah would be so much better if they had DeMar DeRozan playing instead of Rodney Hood.
Nah.
If he was their starting two guard.
I mean, we do have him above Rodney Hood on this list, but I'm not considering Utah one of the best teams in the West. But yeah, they are one team that could use a little bit more scoring punch. So you keep going back to them when you're defending the one-dimensional scorers that you have a fetish for.
I do not have a DeRozan fetish. I do think he's really solid, and you guys are dogging him for the second year straight. All right, we got to wrap things up in the next 10 minutes or so. I have a couple more complaints. Bradley Beal, I think both of you know that if he is healthy this year, 32 will be too low for him.
Like, that's a big if.
Yeah, no, it is, and I'm not going to jinx it, because I remember last summer I came on the pod with you and said 50 was like maybe too high for him considering his health, so I'm not going to come
here.
So
we were right, though. Is that what you're saying?
No.
It almost sounded like that. It really did sound like that for a second.
I'm not going to be beating my chest about what Bradley Beal's going to do, but I just would say that
how much higher do you think he really is? I mean, what's his peak? I mean, he's not top 20.
No, I would say 25.
Okay. So you're arguing about a couple slots here.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. All of it. Look, you guys did a good job this year.
Whoa.
Why was Paul Millsap lower than Kevin Love? Can you explain that?
Millsap had a tough year last year. I think he missed having Horford. I think that they had a real synergy and that he was another guy who fell off of his peak year production. And he's past 30 now, and so we expect, that could slide. Also, one thing I factored in with Millsap is he's moving to the show. So, like, it's his life's going to get a lot tougher going from the East to the West.
Look, man, you guys are – the criteria is so fucking confusing because we're supposed to be talking about a vacuum. And if I'm building a team in a vacuum, I would rather have a guy who could play
D. But the thing is, critics like you don't stick to the vacuum test. You kill us and say, oh, he had a down year, he had a down year, he had a down year. So we do have to kind of consider these other factors. Now, obviously – if you're going to throw him out there completely in a vacuum, the fact that he has had two bad three-point shooting years in a row, they've definitely been down, not quite as good, so he's not quite as valuable there.
Rob, I mean,
definitely is a better passer, playmaker.
I'm cutting Ben off here.
For his teammates.
Rob, would the Cavs be better off with Paul Millsap than they are with Kevin Love?
I mean, I guess that depends on what you expect out of how many games Isaiah Thomas is going to play. Because if you need more of a creator, then I think a guy like Kevin Love is more helpful. If you want someone who can run, you can run your offense through. If you want somebody who can fill more of that need, I think Love has shown he can be that kind of high usage player where Millsap can't. Millsap is just going to be kind of pick up the slack type of contributor on that end of the floor. And so his defense might be more helpful in a playoff series. I would certainly trust him a lot more to deal with the problems that the Cavs need to deal with. But, I mean, I think they might stick to their guns with Love on that one just because they know what he is in terms of a spot-up guy, and they know what he can bring to the table, you know, if they need him to help carry bench units while Isaiah's out and LeBron is sitting.
Okay.
I love Millsap. I think that they would actually want to have Love. I'd be just because of the scoring ceiling. You know, I think.
Really? Yeah. Even matching up with the Warriors?
I think they got to get there first. I mean, I think that we really have to think about this Cleveland team as like what we thought we knew about them in terms of breezing all the way. Like, they're definitely still the favorites, but they're not breezing.
Talk about Love as like a high usage guy. Mm-hmm. He hasn't been that guy for 4 years.
He's going to be that guy this year. He's going to be their number two scoring option. There's no doubt about it.
Okay. I'll believe it when I see it.
Well, believe it on opening night when they don't have Isaiah out there and it's him. It's LeBron and him taking turns scoring.
Yeah, but as far as creation, I think LeBron is going to still bear the lion's share of that load.
LeBron is the best player in the world.
All right. All right. Talk me through how Boogie is higher than Marc Gasol on this list, because Marc Gasol checks every one of your bullshit basketball hipster boxes. And I just don't understand. Like, I think if you're going off...
Show Rob some respect. You don't have to show me any respect. don't be throwing profanity and these, like, just ridiculously, like, undercutting terminology, okay? Rob's a good dude.
If we're talking about pure talent, Boogie is top 15. If we're talking about fit and character and intangibles and all sorts of that, all of that stuff, I don't see how he's possibly above Marc Gasol. So which one of you made that decision? Is this another one where you jumped off the cliff together?
Every decision, we jump off the cliff together.
You're a unified front, like two good parents.
We're lockstep. We're sort of like the basketball internet's version of Garpax. You always have to refer to us as the full name. No, here was the thing with Cousins. This says more about Cousins and how we treat him than it did about Gasol, because we did the game constantly of like, well, would you rather have player X or Cousins?
Uh-huh.
And it would always be player X. And we realized if we kept playing that game, Cousins just wouldn't even be on the list. He doesn't make his teammates better. He's got this consistent track record of just being fit problems, you know, lineup issues. What position does he play? Defensively, consistency, going after the refs. I mean, all the stuff that people get down on Cousins for. There's always going to be somebody who you would just prefer to have in your locker room than DeMarcus Cousins, right? So
yeah.
He fell like 10, 15 spots, maybe 10 spots from last year. Based largely on that test, because we had now seen two separate scenarios in both Sacramento and New Orleans where some of the same issues were coming up. We couldn't just blame the Kings' dysfunction anymore. We are starting to see more vacuum episodes of Cousins that confirmed the downside of some of his limitations than we had known, say, last year when we did this ranking. In terms of him versus Gasol, I think Gasol, a lot of it was age-related. His rebounding numbers have slipped a little bit. I think he's had some health issues. You know, if Rob and I are picking, like, which guy do we want for our team, I would bet both of us would just take Marc Gasol, the solid, the sure guy. I think he slipped a little bit defensively as well. You know, after he's turned 30, he's not quite that defensive player of the year perennial candidate that he was, you know, maybe during his peak years.
Uh-huh.
This was more out of, like, we don't want to completely slander and underrate Cousins' talent.
Okay. And were you on board with that, Rob?
I mean, this exercise was excruciating, like Ben said. I mean, we really did jockey with moving him around all over the board on the would you rather have player X or Cousins test, especially because like there are NBA people who will tell you that they wouldn't take him on their team under any circumstances. And the truth to that, I mean, it could be an exaggeration.
No, I think it's true. Always, I've heard that too. A large percentage of the league is out on Boogie.
Yeah, you'd rather have Waiters play center than DeMarcus Cousins.
I think we could all agree that my team would have a tumultuous regular season and a much higher ceiling in the playoffs, whereas your team of Chris Middleton and Marcus Gasol and Elfrid Payton would be real solid through April and then just get rolled. But yes, so Gasol, I'm sure it was heartbreaking for you, and I'm proud of you for ranking Boogie above him. I was surprised because it seemed like a departure from your methodology.
No, he was way above Gasol last year. So that's the thing is, like, I think we actually, if anything, we overrated Cousins' talent last year, because what I always do is I do those player comps for stats. And, like, if you look in terms of stat producing centers, he is the best since Shaq, period. I mean, this guy is just off the charts in terms of his numbers. And, I think this year more than any other, we considered the costs that come along with having him get those numbers. Basically, like how empty are his stats? And I think in Sacramento, the argument was, well, he has to always do it, right? Like he's the whole team. They don't have a lot of other talent. He's sort of the martyr ball type center, right? Similar to Westbrook in Oklahoma City. And I think his numbers just aren't translating to winning enough in either one of those situations for us to totally buy into them like we did in the past.
Yeah. I mean, we still don't know. Like, the Pelicans are the biggest wild card in the league right now.
Do you think they're going to work?
I would bet against it only because I don't totally trust. I don't know if Gentry is the guy that should be trying to make that work.
Yeah.
We've basically seen like 3 weeks.
And here's another one that's good and I think illustrative. Who is the coach that would be able to make this work?
I'm not sure. But right? I'm still a Boogie believer. I don't think that New Orleans is where it's going to work, though. All right, last spot, though. The 21, 20, 19, and 18. Kyrie, Clay, Kyle Lowry, Mike Conley. Now, you guys say that health matters. Lowry's had health issues, I think, every year for the last 3 years.
No, just last year, but okay.
Well, no, because he was battling something 2 years ago when he like mysteriously fell off the face of the earth in the playoffs, and he had some sort of nagging injury. But he's another guy who doesn't really show up in the playoffs and apparently is not being penalized for it here since he's behind two world champions in Clay and Kyrie, both of whom can hang in the playoffs. And Conley's look, Mike Conley's really solid, but he feels overrated next to Clay and Kyrie.
It's just hilarious because Conley had the best playoffs of any of those four guys. Conley killed it. I mean, it was only one series, but
it was one series. He lost in five games, sure.
No, but he was fantastic. I mean, he was absolutely unbelievable. If you're saying who can show up in the playoffs,
I would look pretty fantastic if Tony Parker were trying to guard me.
Mike Conley would look unbelievable if he played in the Eastern Conference like Kyle Lowry.
Exactly. Both of them should be behind Kyrie.
No.
Both of them.
Look, this is almost to the point where it's self-parody. You just go for the scores every single time. You underrate defense. You underrate all-around players. It's the same argument every single time, man. We've been through this.
No, we just went through this with Boogie. I don't think if you went around to 25 teams, I don't think anybody would take Conley over Kyrie, in large part because of their ceiling.
No, man. For 1 year?
Rob, Ben and I are getting legitimately upset in the studio right now. I'm actually pissed off. I'm not a Kyrie guy. I think he's a top 20 player. It matters that he can take over playoff games. Mm. Conley's not doing that effectively.
He just did. He had a great postseason, like we said.
All of those games.
He's been to the Western
Conference
Finals.
Kawhi took over those games.
But he's doing it in a much tougher conference against much tougher competition. Year in, year out, they're consistently winning playoff series.
He's
they took him to the Western Conference Finals. He had a
career
year. Is it
going to be healthy all year?
Career year last year. Oh, yeah, Kyrie's a picture of health. Give me a break.
I mean, that's the thing with the health argument, too. I mean, Kyrie's missed, what, like 40 games over the last two seasons, I think?
Yep.
Conley definitely gets injured. He also comes back from injury faster than maybe any other player in the league.
Yes,
he's
doesn't
coming off
seem
of
human.
A, you know, career best, basically, across the board. I think the argument against him is just based on his age curve. You know, he's probably due for a slight decline, whereas guys like Irving could potentially get better.
Right.
I think there's enough gap for him to close, though, in terms of, you know, Mike Conley is a guy who has shown more than a passing and occasional interest in playing defense, but you can count on to actually defend for, I don't know, more than 15 regular season games and a handful of postseason games.
So
and
I hear
know,
you
I just
on
don't
that.
Put a ton of stock.
But like, how valuable is that skill at the point guard position? Because
valuable enough to make them a consistent winner, a model franchise for a place that's had a lot of trouble filling out around him.
All
and
right,
Marc Gasol.
Take it down a notch here. The model franchise. They've been like in seventh seed no man's land for the better part of the last 5 years.
Yeah, ask their fans, though. They've got a great fan base there in Memphis.
I'm just saying, if you go through the top 15 and find every guard, none of them play defense. And I think that
Chris Paul, number 7?
Okay, Chris Paul, fine. James Harden, Russ, Steph, John Wall, everybody's a little suspect on that
end. John Wall
end.
Could play and better defense, but he plays defense.
It speaks to how irrelevant that skill is when it comes to assessing the best point guards in the league.
Look, I would agree that there has been a slight warping effect towards offense being more important than defense, but guys like Kyrie and Isaiah are not just like, you know, average or slightly below average defensively. They're really bad. And so if you're not an elite playmaker for others, Kyrie is not that. You know, if you're not a guy who's shown that he can lead a winning team, if you're not, you know, himself, not in LeBron's shadow, but himself, if you're not a guy who's consistently, you know, positive net ratings when you're on and LeBron's off, what are you really doing if you're not playing defense at all? How helpful are you going to be? I mean, I think if you're looking for any reason to be skeptical about Boston, it starts with Kyrie.
Yeah, I mean, I think Kyrie is going to go there and score his ass off. And yeah. Boston, like most teams would do with a great point guard, is going to find ways to hide him on defense. Yeah. And that is something that, like, granted, the Grizzlies don't have to do that with Conley, but they also can't count on him to carry them.
And who wins a playoff series last year? Memphis? Or this new Celtics team with Kyrie? You're amazing.
The new Celtics team, but that's partly...
Really? Hey, a three-deep Celtics team versus that Grizzlies team?
Definitely.
Oh,
Rob,
crazy.
Back me up. Come on.
I'm just like... The Kyrie stuff is so strange to me because I think what Ben brought up about him playing without LeBron, to me, is so damning. Like, every instance we've seen him without the best player in the world on the floor has been really concerning. And so... Yeah, there are times where he'll, you know, pop off in a playoff series and look really great. He'll carry them for stretches. He'll do great things for the offense. But, like, again, if you can't count on that guy to elevate lesser players, what are we really talking about when we're in range of – these are all kind of first-option guys on a team. Mike Conley was the best player on a good playoff team last season, had a great playoffs, will actually defend. I mean, Kyrie Irving, yeah. I mean, he's going to score a lot for the Celtics. I, again, don't think he's going to be the best player on his own team.
Interesting. I think that Marc Gasol was probably the best player on that Grizzlies team.
You're completely wrong.
The DNA and the reason they win is because of the defense that he holds together.
That's a smart take 2 years ago. Mike Conley has passed him.
Okay. Well, do you have any final thoughts here? And by the way, I'm not super high on Kyrie. I'm not arguing that he should be above Wall. Yeah. I think one spot behind Lillard is right for him. And you were close. I think Lillard's
you,
a little bit better.
You would say Lillard over Kyrie.
Yes. And
even though, I mean,
You said Lillard over Conley for all the same reasons that Kyrie should be above him.
I'm asking you, based on the arguments you just made on behalf of Kyrie, wouldn't you say he's going to have a higher scoring average than Lillard next year?
No, I think Lillard is going to be more consistent. And if you put Lillard in Boston's system, he would be even better than Kyrie will be. And look, Kyrie's not perfect, and if anything, his strengths have been overstated over the last few weeks.
And like over the last 3 minutes?
No, I'm just trying to balance it out, all right? I don't think any team would take Conley over Kyrie unless
crazy.
They were trying to like
you're crazy.
Go nuts and get a seventh seed.
If they're trying to win, they're taking Mike Conley.
Do you have any final thoughts, Rob?
Just that there's a point in this process when, you know, Ben is like, okay, who would you rather have between Dennis Schroeder and Victor Oladipo and Reggie Jackson, where I just want to set my phone on fire and throw it off, I don't know, the highest thing I can find. And you know, being able to circle back does offer this process some redemption. There are some dark days when you get into the 70s and 80s and you're comparing like the most minor differences between merely solid players.
Right.
But this is the fun part, is the circling back for sure. So thanks for having me.
I have one last question, Rob, and it's about something that I said to you last night while I was in the middle of writing the last two blurbs, Kevin Durant at number two and LeBron at number one. And after I finished Durant's blurb, I had a very strong sensation course through my body, which was that he probably should be number one over LeBron this year based on the projection of Golden State's going to be completely setting him up for massive success. They're almost certainly going to win the title again. He's got a great shot at both MVP and Finals MVP just based on the stability factor. LeBron has sort of none of those things and is heading into a situation where his free agency could become this gigantic distraction that winds up taking a toll on his reputation, because people are going to blame him for Kyrie wanting out and potentially blame him for leaving Cleveland hanging. And I was wondering, if we get to next June, if we're going to wish we had preemptively pulled the trigger and said, this is the year KD passes LeBron, or are we going to feel comfortable passing that buck for another year?
You did play it a little safe.
We did.
With the top 15.
If you want to call us weak for that, I actually, you know what, make that case. Make that case. Just call us the chickens.
No, I just, the top 15 feels exactly right for September 2017. I think that by the time we get to April and May, it's going to start to, there's going to be a little shakeup.
I agree. I think, I would say we took a bet
on, not necessarily with KD.
I mean, this is a much smaller one. We took a bet on Gobert, though. I mean, having him at 15, I think that's higher than a lot of people would have. And there could be a couple others. Giannis, I mean, we're banking on him really taking another step, I think. But yes, I mean, Rob, when I was texting you saying we should flip KD and LeBron at the last minute, or we should think about it, or I'm predicting for sure KD is going to be number one next year, what did you think? I mean, do you think I just lost my mind, or could you see where I was going?
I thought you were the Dwight Howard of this list, and someone had offered you candy in exchange for moving Kevin Durant to the top. You got on a plane, and when you landed, you had a completely different answer than the one that we had left with.
Yeah,
it's so close. I mean, I think there's a very real possibility Durant could be the next year, but you just can't do that to LeBron. He's too good. He's been too good for too long. I need someone to beat me over the top of the head with someone else being better before I'm willing to admit it, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a safe play.
He did have a 33-point triple-double. I know it was only a five-game series. Now you're discounting the performance in these shorter series, but 33-point triple-double in the final is pretty impressive.
My final thought is you both have done a great job.
Thanks, Andrew.
And I'm shocked at how much went into this. I remember during the eclipse, I was texting Golliver to find out what kind of photo equipment he was using, only to find out that he had just gotten off a three-hour call with you, one of many, I'm sure, and missed the eclipse entirely for the sake of the top 100.
There'll be another one in like 17 years.
For real, though, you did a really good job. I will be proven right on Devin Booker and Kyrie over Conley, and you're never going to really sell me on Cody Zeller. I mean, you know, we can't all agree. But I really appreciate this, and I appreciate anyone who took an hour and a half to listen to this podcast. We've been all over the place, but that's what September is for yelling about stuff that means absolutely nothing.
Yeah, Rob, thanks for coming on and talk to us about this. Any final shots you want to get out there?
I just really hope we're not making the top 100 of 2034 or whatever when the next eclipse rolls around. So help me, please.
for Ben's sake.
No, I'm looking forward to that list. Let's get started on it tomorrow.
All right. Well, we'll be back next week. And thanks again, Rob, for taking the time. This was fun. And subscribe, review, rate. If you have
five stars.
If you have thoughts on Trevor Ariza's place in the top 100, please let us know in the iTunes reviews.
Five-star reviews on iTunes, openfloormail@gmail.com. For all of your questions, Ben.Golliver on Instagram for all of your art criticism. At Rob Mahoney on Twitter for your incredible, insightful basketball opinions. And Andrew, we're going to double back again sometime soon for another pod. Until then, I'll talk to you.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.